Okay, we're going to go ahead and get started. As people come, they can filter in. My name is Jay Smith, for so those of you who are new. The two of us will be doing the session today. We're both from London. We both work with Muslims. I've been working with Muslims for 20 years in West Africa and also in London and a little bit in France. Now, yesterday we went into the historical critique of looking at the hadith, the traditions. What I'm going to do today is we're going to zero in on the Quran, and I'm going to really take on much of the Quranic material. Keith's going to follow up with some of the manuscript evidence. That's his area of expertise, looking at both the Bible and the Quran from that evidence. What I want to do is help you to understand or help you to work with Muslims starting from an internal critique. When you deal with Muslims, you're going to have to talk about the Quran. You're going to have to talk about the Bible. Every discussion you have will come back to Revelation. And what we do in London, we help people go down to dialogue with Muslims. But when that question comes up concerning Revelation, there's handouts there if you need them for today's session. In fact, let me just put them on the chair here so we can just... Here you go. There are handouts on. And just put them on the chair down there when you're finished. Now, the first thing I ask students to do is find out what the Muslims claim about their Quran. Find out what they're saying. Get from them what their beliefs are. Because what you will find, almost immediately, they'll probably use the word inimitable. But what they're saying, basically, are these things here. They'll say, first and foremost, it is superior to all revelations. Stylistically, it is perfect. Grammatically, it is perfect. Some will say linguistically, it is perfect. Others will say it's universally applicable or unique. It was compiled perfectly, has no contradictions, has no errors, has no history. Now, you may not get all of these. These are the ones that we're getting. These are the ones that we hear when we talk to Muslims. And what I'm going to do is take each one of these and help you to understand or help you to use them to deconstruct the Quran using their claims. Starting with their claims, what can you do to deconstruct it? Let's start then with the inimitable claims coming out of the Hadith, the sayings of the Prophet, Mishkat 3, which are the compilations of the six most authoritative Hadith, you have this reference. The Quran is the greatest wonder among the wonders of the world. This book is second to none in the world according to the unanimous decision of the learned men in points of diction, style, rhetoric, thoughts, and soundness of laws and regulations to shape the destinies of mankind. Now, many times when we get into this discussion, and usually I find when you go through the historical difficulties with the Quran or you go through some of the application of the Quran, usually they'll come up with this claim here coming out of Surah 10 and also Surah 2 and 17. Surah means book, ayah means verse. Whenever I say Surah, ayah means book and verse. And what it is very simply, Muhammad hath forged it, answer, bring therefore a chapter like unto it. Bring therefore a chapter like unto it, and call whom ye will to assistance besides Allah if ye shall speak. The surah-like it argument. Usually that happens at the end of a discussion. I find usually by the time you get to that claim, they've really run out of ideas. And we find this certainly when we're debating Muslims. But this is the claim the Quran makes. There is no surah, no book, no verse that can become close to the Quran. It is the mother of books, according to Surah 43:3. Now, you can do a number of things with that. They say it has perfect literary style. Well, let's look at some of the literary style. And what we have done is given you some surahs that you can use in discussion with them and compare them to some biblical passages like with like. You can do it this way if you want to. And these will all be up there. These are a list that was put together by Gerhard Nels there in South Africa. That's one area you can do. And we use this all the time at Speaker's Corner or when we're on university campuses. We'll just say, let's do some comparisons. If that works for you. What I like to do is whenever I get that surah like it claim, I go right to the Bible and I say, well, here, let me show you a surah from the Bible that is better. And I usually like Psalm 23. I did a debate with Sheikh Omar Bakri at Trafalgar Square when he made this claim. And there in front of thousands of Muslims, I started reading Psalm 23 slowly, sedately, in the microphone so everybody could hear. And then after I'd finished Psalm 23, I turned to him and says, now you show me a surah like that anywhere in the Quran. Do that, because don't run away from this argument. It's a good one to do. Now, what it does, two things. First, you've nipped that in the bud. But second, you've elevated the Bible to where it belongs. We need to start doing that with Muslims. Don't be afraid to read from the Bible. And what you will find is because they have given the challenge, you have answered the challenge, right away then say, now let me tell you why it's better. And you can start preaching. And that's what I love to do. Preach from whatever chapter you like. If it's Psalm 2 or Psalm 1 or 1 Corinthians 13, feel free to do that because you've got the right to do so because they made the challenge. All right? And what you find is that Muslims won't ask you a second time. Usually that challenge doesn't come up again. But use it to your own advantage. We need to start putting the Bible in the public sphere, and we need to start making that challenge, because we don't make this claim, but we can certainly nip that in the bud by using and going back to that claim. It does have a lot of literary defect. It's not chronological. Those of you, how many people have tried to read the Quran? Okay, good, most of you. What's been your impression when you've read it? Why?
It's fragments.
Okay, it's fragmented. What's been your impression? Okay, go ahead. Painful, okay. Yeah.
Can I ask this question? Does this have to be done in Arabic, since the Quran is written in Arabic, and meaning that is the right version?
Good question, and this will come up all the time. Well, you cannot really understand it unless you understand the Arabic. Now, ask and find out if the person who's saying that understands Arabic. What you will find is the vast majority of Muslims don't speak Arabic or Quranic Arabic. Only 13% of the Muslim world speaks Arabic. Certainly those in Europe, the most of them who are making this claim, usually are not Arabic speakers themselves. So you ask them, where are they getting their material from? They're going back to the English Quran or the French Quran or the Dutch Quran. They're going back to translations. And although they don't call them translation, they'll call them interpretations. All right, so make sure you do that. Yeah, go ahead. It's all going to be up on the internet. Yeah. All of this will be up on the internet. We're going to go through a lot of data just because we only have a short bit of time. And this is a big subject. It's a huge subject. It is not chronological. You will find it jumps all over the place. Here's notes for today if you don't have them. Okay. It jumps all over the place. There is no story that's complete except for Surah 12, which is the story of Joseph. That's the only complete story in the Quran. Jumps all over the place. There's no transitional phrases to help you to go from story to story. Because of that, most Muslims don't read the Quran. They don't go to the Quran like we go to the Bible for Quranic studies. If they go to Quranic studies, they're memorizing it. And usually they're memorizing it in Arabic. They don't understand the word they're memorizing. I have a good friend named Ishmael who has memorized the entire Quran there in London. And I will sit to him and I say, come on, give me Surah 2:145. And he stops and thinks, and perfect word for word. Then I say, what have you just said? He said, Mr. Smith, please, I don't know what I've said. For him, it's not important that he understands it. He must memorize it. And it's almost as if I were to ask you all to memorize the New Testament in Greek, because that's about the size of the Quran. Can you see why they're doing it? They're not doing it to understand it. They're doing it to basically to receive barakah, to get those good, that blessing on their right shoulder and recorded by that angel that we were talking about yesterday. So, not chronological, endless repetitions, jumps from one topic to the next, inconsistencies in grammar, law, and theology, verbs left out. Let me tell you, give me some response to this. Now, Al-Rumini, in the 10th century, argued that the ellipses and grammatical irregularities were really positive devices rather than evidence of rushed or sloppy writing. Now, this is his defense of many of these claims. Let's see what some of the scholars today are saying. Well, let's go back to the 9th century and look what Al-Kindi said. Al-Kindi was working in the courts of Mamun, and he was right there while what we're finding out, many of the traditions were being written, being compiled, that speak about the creation of the Quran. And this is what he came up with. The result of all this process by which the Quran came into being is patent to you who have read the scriptures and see how in your book histories are all jumbled together and intermingled, and evidence that many different hands have been at work therein and caused discrepancies, adding, cutting, and whatever they like or disliked, are such now the conditions of a revelation sent down from heaven, translated by Muir in 1882. This has always been dispelled. No one really took Al-Kindi seriously until we started going back and looking and realizing that many of the claims that the Muslims have been giving, certainly about the historicity of how the Quran was put together and compiled and when it was compiled, we're now realizing that a lot of it was compiled much later from what we were talking about yesterday in the historical critique. Now we realize that Al-Kindi was right there. He was witnessing this as it was going on. No wonder he made this claim. Now we're going back and reassessing what he's been saying. The experts today, what do they say? Samuel Reinach, coming out of Germany, says, from the literary point of view, the Quran has little merit. Declamation, repetition, puerility, lack of logic and coherence strike the unprepared reader at every turn. It is humiliating to the human intellect to think that this mediocre literature has been the subject of innumerable commentaries, and the million of men are still wasting time in absorbing it. Now, Reinach has a right to say that because he spent his life studying this book. Noldecki from Germany also made this reference to the Quran. It is full of chaotic confusion, prosaic, stiff in style, tedious sermonizing, rhetorical, never metrical, the rhyme on the whole a burdensome yoke, superfluous verbiage, syntax betrays great awkwardness, tiresome effect of its endless iterations, so that dogma turns a defective literary production into an unrivaled masterpiece in the eyes of the believer. fascinating. These are the conclusions they're coming to. If those of you who have studied the Quran, if you're coming to these conclusions, be careful how you say it. Don't refer to these fellows. Make sure that you're aware of who you're talking to. That's another quote from McClintock. Let's now go to the... We won't go into the grammatical problems because unless you know Arabic, this is not going to really help you. Let those who know Arabic, let those who are Arabic speakers deal with this. There's lots of grammatical errors. We've got them tabulated. There's some outlines if you don't have it here. What about the fact that it uses perfect Arabic? There is lots of words that we've come across in the Quran that is not perfect Arabic. In fact, what is ironic, you'll find words from Egyptian, Hebrew, Syriac, Christian Aramaic, and Ethiopic words. Lots of Syriac words that we have found, primarily because about 75% of the foreign words in the Quran are from the Syriac, primarily as we're now finding out a good bit of the Quran has been borrowed from Syriac writings. What they're claiming is that you will only find perfect Arabic in the Quran. And what we're realizing is there's lots of foreign words that have been borrowed, which have Arab equivalents. Let me give you some examples. Adam. 24 times you'll find that word. The correct term for Adam in Arabic would have been Basharan or Insan. Or take the Assyrian word of Ibrahim. The equivalent would have been Ibrahim. Or the Persian words like Siddat, that bridge that goes across from earth over into paradise that goes over hell. Sit up the path also has an equivalent in Persian, I'm sorry, in Arabic, Al-Tariq, Hur, the disciple, has an equivalent, Arab equivalent for Tilmith, Firdaus, the highest seventh heaven. The Arab equivalent is Jannah. Why were these non-Arab words used? And why did they not, therefore, why did they borrow from these other sightings? What we're now realizing is almost all these ideas have been borrowed from texts that came from those sources. We'll get into that a little bit later. They say it's universal. One of the things we do in London is we take this claim on board and we look through basically two areas to discuss with Muslims. One is on women's rights in the Quran, looking at the polygamy, wife beating in Surah 434. Some of you who were in London last year when Yusuf al-Qaradawi came from Qatar and they made that infamous reference there at Heathrow Airport saying that women, men may beat women because of Surah 434. Fascinating. I did a debate in Cambridge University with one of the politicians there in London, Dr. Tamimi. Is that his name? Tamimi. I forget his name. Dr. Tamimi, who is the head of the Muslim Association of Britain. And I brought up Surah 434, and he said, "Mr. Smith, there's nothing wrong with that because there is a gradation. You start with first admonishing your wife, and then if that doesn't work, then you throw her from your bed. And if that doesn't work, only then do you beat her. And then as an afterthought," he says, "besides, I know many women that love to be beaten." You don't say that at Cambridge University. And he lost the debate on that one point. So you can see the difficulty with a lot of the women's positions there in the Quran. We're now taking Muslims to boot on this. We're asking them to go public with this material and to try to come up with some type of reference points on it. We look in, and we don't have time today to go through the biblical references, which is a good corrective on just that. They would. It depends on who you're talking to. If you're talking to a liberal and moderate Muslim, they'll say that is something that is for the 7th century. It's no longer for today. But for many Muslims, they'll immediately attack that, and they say the Quran is relevant for all ages, all times. It is universal context. Therefore, we've got to understand who the concubines were at that time. We've got to understand what the slavery was happening during the Prophet's time. Only then can we say what's going on today. Can we therefore use it today? And, of course, that binds them. There's the difficulty. And you can use that, bring it up, certainly use it in conversation and see how they answer it. Paradise. Looking at paradise, we won't get into it today because there's just too much material here. This is a good one that I'll have women do, going to Surah 56 and Surah 55, and having them go and talk to their female friends to walk them through those two surahs to help them understand as women what's waiting for them. Because what you will find is many women are not aware of this. Many Muslim women have never read these references. They don't know what's waiting for them. They have not gone to the hadith, to the infamous hadith, where Muhammad was given a vision of paradise, and he was given a vision of hell. And when he looked at the vision of paradise, he saw that the majority of them, of those there, were men, and there in hell, the majority of those were women. And when asked by his wife, Aisha, why the majority of men were in heaven, he said, "Well, women are more disobedient and less intelligent." Interesting. Using that hadith, using these scriptures, for women especially, for you in the back, you can take these to your Muslim friends. Do that and see what they say. and ask them, as a woman, what's waiting for me in paradise? So is it a universal application, or is this really reflective of what's happening in the 7th century? Perfectly legitimate to do that. Probably the best thing to do is to go right into violence. We do this all the time at Speaker's Corner. We look and we ask, and we're going to do that tomorrow. I'm not going to go in today. We're going to look at peace and violence in the Quran. We're going to ask, where are those peace verses? What do we find, especially when we go to the Medinan surahs, when you find 149 sword verses, 149 very violent verses. These are the most authoritative verses because they're at the end. When you look at the law of abrogation, they abrogate anything that's gone before. When you put them together, you need to understand that the radicals really have the agenda because they are looking at the Quran correctly. And you've got to say, is this relevant for today? Is this a universal application? Can you really say that the Quran is a universal document that is applicable for, certainly post 911? And then, of course, the beauty is you can go right to the New Testament. You can go to the person of Jesus Christ, and you can go to the gospel. And it's so nice to be able to have that apologetic, to do a comparative right there. We do it almost weekly at Speaker's Corner and elsewhere. They claim that the Quran was collated perfectly. Now, Arthur Jeffries, in the 1930s to the 1950s, went back and did an enormous amount of work looking at the traditions, at the hadith. Certainly at the Sira of the Prophet. He looked at the Tafsir and the Tahriq, those four genres of literature. And what he found, especially coming out of the hadith of Bukhari and Sahih Muslim and Ibn Dawud, by looking at them, he was able to bring together about 16 different codices that he was able to refer to that the traditional compilers in the 9th and 10th century were referring to. Four of them were what we call the metropolitan codices. The codice that was there became popular in Medina, Zayd ibn Thabit's codice that is now considered to be the Uthmanic recension. That's this one we have in our hand today. This would be Zayd ibn Thabit's Uthmanic recension. And then, of course, you have Abdullah ibn Masud, whose codex became very popular in Kufa, just south of Baghdad. Abu Musa's, whose codex became very popular in Basra, and Ubay ibn Ka'b's codex became very popular in Damascus. What is interesting is they do not agree. In fact, he found 15,000 differences between these four codices. Fascinating that Muslims aren't telling us about this. We need to do more research into it. When you start looking at, of course, the traditions tell us an enormous amount, and we could go into this in more detail, but basically when you go back to men like Sahih Bukhari, you'll find that the first codex that was given to Abu Bakr also seems to suggest that there was also a copy that was given to someone else. And in this case, Salim, the freed slave. Which is the original codex? Is it Abu Bakr's or is it Salim? When we go down to Ibn Dawud, we find that portions of the Quran were irretrievably lost in the Battle of Yamama. We head on down, we find that the entire portions were omitted and abrogated according to Suyuti in Sahih Muslim. We also find that Al-Ash'ari mentions that a verse that Muhammad once remembered no longer exists according to Sahih Muslim. Bukhari also refers to verses which have been canceled or abrogated. And, of course, the notorious verse on Rajam, this verse on stoning, missing verse that was there originally, but Umar complains, what's going to happen when people read the Quran? They're not going to find this verse on stoning. We used to stone, the Prophet used to stone after him. Where's that verse? They're going to complain that it's not there. You can see the problem if this verse is no longer there. Now you'll find only 100 lashes. Or the fact that Muhammad himself had difficulty remembering portions of the Quran, according to Sunnah Abu Dawud. The most notorious ones are these two that I'm going to show right now. From volume number 6, hadith number 509 and 510, coming out of Al-Bukhari, which talks about how the final recension that we have in our hand today, Zayd ibn Thabit's recension, was finally tabulated, taken from a copy that Hafsa hid under her bed from 634. It was then brought back out in 650, mid-7th century, and Uthman then had Zayd ibn Thabit, along with three others, Zubair al-Harith and Al-As, the four of them, rewrite the Quran, rewrite this manuscript. And if they had any disagreement, they were to use the Qurayshi dialect. Now, Keith, I don't know if you're going to get into this, but when you ask about dialectic differences, you cannot have dialectic differences in the 7th century because the Dhamma, the Fatah, and the Kasra, which are used to show dialectic differences, the vowelization was not even introduced until the late 8th century. It's another 100 years later. So obviously, you've got a problem. Even Bukhari has a difficulty here, but then he's writing in the 9th century. He's redacting this back into the 7th century. He didn't know his own history. But what is most curious is that when this final copy was compiled, then Uthman took all the other manuscripts and had them burnt. Why do you burn manuscripts? unless, of course, there is not dialectical differences, there is consonantal differences. And Keith, I think, is going to get into that more clearly. So what we find, according to Ibn Dawud, the parts of the Quran were lost. According to Suyuti, some of it disappeared. According to Sahih Muslim, some of it was forgotten. Bukhari, others of it was canceled. Sahih Bukhari also says much of it was missing. Some was overlooked. According to Ibn Malik, some was changed. A good bit of the Quran, according to Ibn Dawud, was modified. Lost, disappeared, forgotten, canceled, missing, overlooked, changed, modified. Does this sound like a book which was collated perfectly and completely? Now, we're asking Muslims this, and you can see they do not like this material. We're using it at Speaker's Corner. They get very angry when we start quoting their own traditions. But see, this is not a Christian polemic, because we're working from within their own traditions. That's why it's so effective. We're using their material. We're going back to people they know. Everybody knows Bukhari unless you're a Shiite. But certainly the Sunnis respect Bukhari. He is second only in authority to the Quran. You've got to go back to the authority and look what they've come up with. There's a huge amount of material that we could be using in our debates, in our apologetics, and our polemics. Now, the Talmudic sources. When you look at a lot of the Quran, you will find a good 70% of the Quran is made up of material that you actually, people that you are, individuals that you know. These are prophets whose names you've heard. These are characters that are in our own scriptures. But when you read their stories, they do not parallel with our stories, and you wonder where they come from. I don't know if you had this chance. If you looked, you noticed this. So we're asking, where are these stories coming from? And we're doing source criticism. We're finding we can almost source almost all of them back to Talmudic sources, to apocryphal writings, and to Christian sectarian writings, like Abraham, the story of Abraham in Surah 21, where he takes in the middle of the night, smashes all these idols with a larger idol. He's asked what's going on the next day. He says, well, ask the larger idol. They take him, they put him into a fiery pit. And the angel of the Lord comes and rescues him out of the fiery pit. Now, it's a great story, but is it in our Bible? Well, I know there's a story of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, which is similar to that, but I'd like to know where this story comes from. We've been able to find it in the Midrash Rabbah. In 171, we find in Mount Sinai, God lifts up Mount Sinai and holds it over the heads of the Jews. That comes from the Abadah Sarah. The story of Cain and Abel is particularly interesting because you have here, Cain kills his brother Abel, doesn't know what to do with the body, so he sees a raven scratching in the ground. He puts the body of his brother there, copying what the raven's doing. We know that story is found in the Targum of John ben Isaiah, from a apocryphal account from the 2nd century. But what is interesting is the next verse, because then in the next verse, chapter 5, verse 32, we have this reference to the blood, and basically it's a comment on the blood of Abel. And it says, for if anyone slew a person, unless it was for murder, it would be as if he slew the whole people. And if anyone saved a life, it would be as if he saved the life of the whole people. This is what is quoted now by many of your Muslims as a peace verse in the Quran. But what's it doing following Surah 5:31? It's almost like a redemptive analysis. And you say, it should not be in the Quran. I'd like to know where it comes from. Well, you can see right away, it has to do with the children of Israel. So you can see immediately, you need to go back and say, where do we found it? We have now found reference to, in fact, we know exactly where it comes from. In the Mishnah Sanhedrin, chapter 4, verse 5, in the 5th century, while the Talmud of Jonathan ben Uzziah was being recopied by a scribe, he wrote in the margins his own surmising of what he felt the blood of Abel was. Wrote it in the margins, so in the 5th century, when that was finally copied over, the story of the raven, Cain and Abel and the raven, along with this reference to the blood of Abel, was incorporated into the text. That both those story and the text then were incorporated into Surah 5, ayah 31 and 32. We know who wrote it. We know when it was written. We know why it was written. None of this comes from divine knowledge. It was written brought long after the Bible was canonized, around the 5th century. We can go right to it in point two, where they're getting this from now. Solomon Sheba, this is a great story. I don't know if you've had a chance to read it in Surah 27. Solomon trains birds for battle, and he sends them up over the enemy with rocks on their talons, and at the bottom of the rocks are the names of the people they're going to be killing. The hoopoe bird's not there one day. He gets very upset. Where's my hoopoe bird? Suddenly it flies from the south, lands at his feet, and he says, where have you been? I've seen a beautiful queen in the south, it says. Solomon talks to birds. He said, well, go down and bring that queen up. I want to see her. So it flies on back down, lands there at the feet of the Queen of Sheba. Now she talks to birds as well, and tells her that this great king of the north wants to meet her. So she comes up with her whole retinue. They go all the way up to Jerusalem. They come into the throne room. There is Solomon sitting on his throne, and he has a mirrored floor in front of him. She's never seen that. They don't have that technology in Sheba. She lifts up her skirts, and that's where the story ends. Now, have you heard that story before? Is it in our Bible? I'd love to know where we get it from, because I've never seen it before, but it does exist. Almost word for word, you can find it in the second Targum of Esther, except there is one salient point that's missing. When she lifts up her skirt, according to the Targum of Esther, she has hairy legs. Solomon, upon seeing the hair, cries out in surprise. You can see why they left that out. But word for word, almost, you can see where they've taken that story and they've put it there into Surah 27. Again, this is a second century apocryphal writing. What are these? These are all stories that the Jews had put together in the diaspora, apocryphal traditions, which makes sense that the Arabs would have come across them because they would have been related in the vernacular. This is before the Bible had been translated, had been written down in Arabic. That was only done in the 8th century, so this is the only material they had access to. No wonder these stories find their way into the Quran and not the authentic biblical stories that we were familiar with. These are some of the sectarian writings coming out of the 2nd century, the story of Mary, Imran, Zacharias, the palm tree that that Jesus uses to eat from with his mother, found from the lost book of the Bibles. Jesus' child, the baby Jesus talking. We now get that out of the first gospel of infancy of Jesus Christ. Creating birds from clay, blowing on them, flying to the air in Surah 3:49 from the Thomas' gospel of infancy of Jesus Christ. So we are now able to go back and source a lot of this material. But then there's the poetry. What are we going to do with the poetry in the Quran? Because, of course, this is what Muslims claim is the miracle of Muhammad, this beautiful poetry. There are two studies being done in Germany, one by a man named Luxemburg, another by Gunther Lulling, a good friend of mine. And I've been there, we've seen him, we commissioned his book. He did a study on this poetry, and he noticed that a lot of these strophes he would recognize because he's a man who is an expert in the Syriac traditions. He went back to the Syriac writings, and what he found was that almost all these lines, these poetic lines that are found in the Quran, they could almost all be traced back to pre-Islamic Christian hymns written in the 5th and 6th century, all written in Syriac and then interposed into Arabic. Line for line, strophe for strophe. Fascinating. There's nothing new under the sun. It's all been borrowed. Now, can you see the difficulty for a Muslim when they make the claim that it's perfect, that it comes from heaven, that it comes from the eternal tablets, according to Surah 85:22, that have always existed, and yet we can now show the human dimension to this material, where they're borrowed, who made them, who wrote them, how they were borrowed, even when they were borrowed. This is going to dash a lot of their proclivities on claiming the perfectness of the Quran. The contradictions. There's a whole slew of contradictions. Be careful. If you're going to get into contradictions with Muslims, be aware of the fact that they'll throw a lot of contradictions at you. And you'll go tit for tat, and you can spend a whole afternoon just wasting your time. So what we have done, there's a very popular book that's been put out by Shabir Ali in Toronto called 101 Clear Contradictions of the Bible. We have taken it, and we've answered every one of them, every one of the 101s, and we've released it as 101 Cleared Up Contradictions of the Bible. Just give them it, okay? Or lead them to our website and they can pull it down. Because you will waste an awful lot of time. Now, these are 12 of the ones that we use at Speaker's Corner that are the easiest to use. If you want to use them, feel free to do so. I find a much more practical thing to do is to go into the errors, the historical anachronisms, the scientific problems. We don't have time to go into it. It would be great if we just go through some of these. But certainly what you will find is that the Bible, the Quran, is full of historical anachronisms, referring to things that could not have existed at that time. The cross that you find in Surah 7 and Surah 12, where Moses the baker there in the time of Joseph was taken out of prison, and this would have been about 1800 BC, and then was crucified. Or the cross that you have in Moses' Pharaoh, he puts his sorcerers on a cross and crucifies him in 1400 BC. How can you have a cross in 1400 BC? And in 1800 BC, when the crucifixion was invented by the Phoenicians, the first example of it that we have documented was Darius in 519 BC. That's 900 to 1,300 years later. And this happens over and over again. You probably are more familiar with Mary, who's referred to in three different surahs as the daughter of Imran and the sister of Aaron. Well, we know that Aaron is the son of Imran, but he's also the brother of Moses, who has a sister named Miriam. But they lived in 1,400 BC. How could Mary, the mother of Jesus, be the same Mary? You've got 1,400 years between them. You've got a difficulty there. Muslims are trying to get out of that one now, and they're saying that, well, she's in the line of Imran, or that there is the Mary of the New Testament, the mother of Jesus, does have a father named Imran, does have a brother named Aaron. Let me just use this one right, because we don't have time to go on all of these. We've got some of these are just exciting to use, and you can just really play with your Muslims who bring these up, or you can just take them to them and just question them and then say, come back next week, come up with the answers. They're good to do that because for many Muslims, they have no idea that these problems exist in the Quran. And the paper we're going to give you that's going to be on the internet, I've got about 30 or 40 of these errors up there. You can pull them down. These 10 that I have here are the easiest ones to use. Let me just give you the example of the didham. The didham, and this will move right into what Keith's going to be saying later, and that is the the story of Joseph again, which is that complete story that we're looking at. When Joseph was sold to the Egyptians, he was sold for a few dirham counted out. And you ask about dirham counted out, you assume therefore you're using coins. You count out coins. And you ask, well, did they have coins at the time of Joseph? There were no coins. If you come to the British Museum, we have a tour there of looking at all the biblical evidence. 2 hours looking at all the biblical evidence, the archaeological evidence of the Old Testament from the Assyrian, Babylonian, and the Persian period. We can show you in the coin, the numismatic section, where there are dirhams, but the fascinating thing is there are no coins prior to the 7th century B.C. Coins didn't exist. It was bullion. It was weighted measure. Well, the Bible also makes claim in Genesis, where we have it here, Genesis 37:28, that Joseph was sold for 20 shekels. Shekels is not a coin. It's a bullion. In fact, we now know from the Newsy tablets that that's about the price of a slave around that time period. So not only does the Bible get the right denomination, it also gets the right currency. Let's go back to the dirham. Well, maybe God was giving a revelation to Muhammad at the time and using a currency that they would have known at that time. So maybe the people who were living there in the 7th century A.D. used dirhams. Did they? No, they didn't. The dirham was only created in 642. Umar was the one that introduced the dirham to replace the drachma. But Muhammad died in 632. So how could Muhammad have received a revelation using a coin that was yet to exist for another 10 years? You've got a problem, don't you? It's as if I was asking you if I could buy that watch back in 1960 for 20 euros. You wouldn't know what I was talking back in 1960. Today you would, but not in 1960. And here you've got a difficulty. And immediately you can see what's going on. It looks like that this was something that was put into the Quran much later. And what we're finding out now is that the Quran did not and was not completed in the 7th century. And Keith's going to get into that in just a few minutes. In fact, I'll let Keith do all of this. Do you have these pictures, Keith? Okay, he'll be talking about the Topkapi. He'll be talking about the Ma'il that he's looking at there at the British Library of the Hijazi text. And he'll be going into how you delineate the different type of scripts that are there. And let's go on just real quickly because I'll let Keith do this. And, of course, the Sana manuscript, which is proving to be beautiful. It has some amazing material. Mm-hmm. This is Dr. Gerrit Prinz. I don't know if you know Dr. Gerrit Prinz, those of you who are from Germany. I went to visit him in 1999, and he showed me the manuscript that they found in 1975. He went to see it in 1981. He was flown down in 1981, and they took pictures of it, but it was not his pictures, his microfilms, were not released to him until 1997. And what they found is, if you look here, you can see two different scripts. This is proving to be one of the oldest scripts. This is dated about 705, early 8th century. On this side over here, you have a completely different script. There you have Surah 19, and it jumps to Surah 22, right there at that yellow mark. What happened to Surah 20 and 21? Well, they begin to appear over on this side in another wholly, entirely different script. This is what we call an Abbasid script, or Eastern Kufic script. And when we're looking at that, we're suddenly realizing you can see an evolution in the Quranic manuscript. This is proving to be the oldest Quran, but parts of it are from different ages that have been added at a much later time. And what's interesting is you look at all these orange marks. These orange marks that you see here are what we call manuscript variants. He's found over 1,000 manuscript variants in just this one manuscript from the early 8th century. I'll let Keith tell you exactly the significance of that. They did some ultraviolet light on this manuscript, and they found a script underneath a script that had been written, then washed off, and another script was overlaid over top of it, both Quranic, but both disagreeing, showing, again, how the Quran has evolved even while these manuscripts were being created there in Sana, possibly at the late 7th to early 8th century. And I think I'll leave it there, Keith, rather than getting into the Bible. You're going to get into the Bible, aren't you? Because we're almost running out of time. Let me hand it over to Cleve there, but let me just finish with these two conclusions. So what have we seen here? What conclusions can we use in the polemics today? First of all, the Quran does not have the historical authority most Muslims desire. It has a history evolving over 100, 200 years, much of it borrowed from other sources. This has serious ramifications for the radical Muslims today, those who go to this book for the most of their theology and practice. And with that, I'll let Keith carry on, and he's going to go into the Bible and look at the manuscript differences between the two scriptures.
What are you trying to do? A couple things. Let me just mention one. I'll give it to Jay for a moment. They're not using a fair standard, whereas we are very seriously attempting to use a fair standard. We also work on two different models of inspiration. And theirs is tied to a mechanical view of inspiration. They believe in a heavenly original for their Quran. They themselves do not think that Muhammad borrowed any of these things. They think he was directly inspired with these stories. So the Arabic, for instance, there are some Muslim scholars who recognize the legitimacy of loan words. But the conservative ones and the ones who are speaking loudest today do not. And they're trying to make this claim that it's in pure Arabic because the Quran speaks that it's revealed in a pure Arabic. We make very realistic claims about the history of our text and have worked very carefully at balancing the human and divine aspects of it. They cut out all human involvement in the reception of Scripture. And that's where all these problems come in and are relevant. So, Jay?
At the very beginning, I said, find out what they claim first. Don't jump into this, obviously, without getting some type of first response from them. I think it's very important that you do find out what they do claim. If it's a liberal Muslim, he won't make quite the same claims that the vast majority of the moderates and certainly the radicals are making. And so that's why it's important that you do see where they stand. If they're not going to make any of those claims that you see up on that list there at the very beginning, then you're going to have to go a whole different route. And what the best thing I do is with people who come from a very liberal standpoint, I say, well, then let's do a comparative Bible and Quran. Let's look and see at least the manuscript evidence that's there. Let's look and see the claims that are there. Is the Quran relevant for today? Is the New Testament, the Gospels relevant for today as my paradigm, as their paradigm? Let's do a comparative. So you can use that route if you want to. But a lot of the Muslims will usually, as soon as you mention the Bible, they'll usually have an attack against it saying it's corrupted. And what we usually do, even before you get into this material, we'll ask them just very two quick questions. Can you tell me where and when? Where it's corrupted, when it's corrupted. And by doing that, you'll find out not only where they stand, not only vis-a-vis our Bible, but where they stand vis-a-vis their Quran. They'll start making Qurans. They'll probably start elevating the Qurans where they have no right to, but they'll start denigrating the scriptures quickly. And most of them will not be able to support it. The vast majority just have heard it from their imam or they read it in a piece of literature put out by Didat or some other populist piece of literature. You've got to take those on board and you've got to then say, listen, let me just show you just how much authority we have. Now, we haven't had time to do that. That's the other half. On the internet, you'll get that material down. Just looking at just how much authority we do have vis-a-vis their claims.
By the way, the question, we're supposed to repeat the questions for the mic. The question was, are we using a fair standard in how we're looking at sources when we compare the Quran to the Bible? Just one other aspect of that, too. Jay's really emphasized written literary sources for so many of these stories in the Quran. And one thing you have to keep in mind is that from what we can tell of 7th century Arabia, the Arabs did not use written literature to record their cultural and religious heritage. They used Arabic script mainly for business transactions and administrative documents, but for their culture, they used oral transmission. And it was very much a storyteller's culture. And so these stories that we know initially had their source in these Jewish works and Christian apocrypha. You can even trace antecedents in Manichaeism, in Gnostic sources. It came through an oral filter to Muhammad. And this is something that Andy Bannister's doing research in, and if you want to pursue that, talk to him afterwards. Muslims don't realize, and they completely ignore the written antecedents to these stories. And the earliest Muslim commentators did this as well. And when they found out that there were Jewish antecedents, they hushed it up. So, right. I'm doing research in comparative textual criticism. And I want to just zero in on this one facet of the whole question. I mean, Jay's gone through, 90 different things that could be looked at in this kind of detail. But I want to zero in on this because this is crucial for our scriptures because they claim that the Quran has been preserved perfectly. They don't make the claim just reliably. They say the Quran's been preserved perfectly, letter for letter. Just get this. There we go. First of all, I want you to just think through with me for a minute how a critical text is established. We're gonna look at how the Greek New Testament text, the critical text, the Nestle Allen 27th edition, how it's established. And then think about what would it take to do the same kind of thing for the Arabic text, because it's never been done for the Arabic text of the Quran. Now, for the Nestle Allen text, you have the Greek text at the top, you have the apparatus at the bottom. And the apparatus gives you textual variants. It cites the manuscript or the church father or the translation or the lectionary that it came from. It's a very precise apparatus. And the principles that the text at the top that's viewed as the most reliable text is done according to methods that are known, that are tested, that are debated, that have been worked through for a couple hundred years. Now there's still debates going on, but there's a huge measure of agreement on how you justify the basic text of the New Testament. This is what you'll see when you look at a Quran text. One text. For the New Testament, it's been done from existing manuscripts that have been collated into text families, Alexandrian, Western, Byzantine, Caesarean. Also, they'll take early translations, lectionaries, quotes in early Christian writings. All of these things evaluated for their contribution to what bearing they have on the original text. Now, for the Quran, it has not been done. But if you were to do it to the same degree of detail as has been done for the New Testament, you would first of all have to take all the existing Quran manuscripts and collate them into families by reading. Now, Muslims tell you there's only one Quran. And actually, in print today, there are two main texts. Now, this one and the only other one you're going to get in Europe or the United States is a text that comes out of Egypt. It's related to an edition that was produced in 1924. It's been revised a little bit by Saudi Arabian authorities, but it's one particular text. But Muslim scholars know that it is one of 80. And this is how it breaks down. In about 930 A.D., 930, there was a scholar named Ibn Mujahid who said, who basically, out of many competing Qurans, Jay mentioned these companions collections, those and others, out of many competing collections, he said, these seven we are going to consider as canonical. Now, the seven all share the same consonantal text. They differed in vowels for the most part. Three more were later added on. So 10 canonical recensions of the Quran that differ in pronunciation. Now, they don't really differ in meaning, but they differ in pronunciation. Each one of those 10 ended up having 8 different transmissions that further differentiated pronunciation. And you actually ended up with 80 different pronunciations of the Quran. They share the same basic consonantal script, but 80 canonical versions. It's not just one Quran. Mode of transmission, it's basically assigned to the name of a man who is a prominent Quran memorizer, and he pronounced it a certain way, and it was considered his transmission. So there are 80 different names, 8 names for each of the 10 original named men. And only 2 of these survive in print today. And they're called the Hafs text, which is the one in print from Egypt, and the Warsh text, which is used in Morocco and Yemen. And if you go to Morocco and buy a Quran in Arabic, it'll probably be the Warsh text. Also, then you'd need to go past those to these companions collections that Jay mentioned. And these differed further. Now, those 80 all share the same consonantal text, same basic basic text. These companions collections had a lot more significant variants. They had consonantal differences. They had words added, phrases added, even complete chapters added or omitted. So you'd have to include those. You'd have to include early translations of the Quran. There are early Persian translations. There's even an early Syriac translation of the Quran. And this early Syriac translation shows some really interesting textual variants. You'd have to also gather quotes like we have from the Church Fathers. You'd have to do it from a whole slew of Arabic writings, the Hadith collections, commentaries, grammatical books, other books, and then also from inscriptions. Like, for instance, the Dome of the Rock in Jerusalem has Quran verses going around the inside. Now, that inscription was put there in 690 AD, and there are two or three verses that are quoted in the course of the inscription. There are some textual variants in it. Also coins, especially with the Abbasids from 750 AD on, they had Quran verses on their coins. The Umayyads also used some. Those are more useful. The coins are more useful for script analysis. But anyway, when you come to the New Testament, you have written variants. When you come to the Quran, you have written and oral variants. And it's this whole phenomena with the Quran of oral transmission and the oral milieu of its origin. And this one scholar, Adrian Brockett, described in this way. With oral tradition, it's characterized by variants resulting from words wrongly heard, from words confused with similar sounding words, from whole episodes being forgotten, misplaced, or reinterpreted. Leaving aside the art of calligraphy, written tradition is characterized by variants resulting from copyist errors, words read wrongly, revised, or left out by a careless eye, and by random passages getting lost or being added to on the basis of other sources. Now, those companions collections show those kind of oral variants. Our New Testament shows these written variants. Now, for instance, Codex Bizet from the 5th century is notorious for being one of the early manuscripts that has a lot of very interesting textual variants. And it contains the Gospel and most of the Book of Acts. Its Book of Acts is 8 to 10% longer than the Book of Acts you'll find in, say, Codex Sinaiticus or Codex Vaticanus. When you look at that extra material, it's not like Paul's got a fourth missionary journey or anything like that. What it is additional words and phrases like what I have highlighted in just this little passage. So that's, when you think of New Testament textual variants, these are the worst kind of things we have. Up to, say, the long ending of Mark, or the pericope of the adult woman caught in adultery in John 8. Okay? So we have variants, the worst variants our New Testament has concern words, concern phrases, concern verses, and concern sections of 8-9 verses long. Now, when you come to actual Quran manuscripts, this is held to be the earliest kind of script used in Quran manuscripts. It's called Hijazi script. This is a manuscript in the Paris Bibliothèque Nationale. And there's a Quran in the British Library that's of this same script. There's also this codex. Many Muslims claim that this particular Quran was one that Uthman published. But you see, it's a very formal script. You see, that one's a lot less formal script. And Western scholars believe this kind of script actually became established in the Abbasid times, 750 and later. But still, this particular Quran is one of the earliest Qurans in existence. Western scholars have dated the earliest Qurans in existence to 750 to 800, except for one or two of the Sana finds, which might be as early as 705, which Jay mentioned. The one that might be 705
is of that script style. Now, one thing you notice about both of these, they have very few dots when you compare them to that. All the dashes and marks above the text, above the line, they're vowels. And those are the things like what Jay was saying that determine dialects. The dots that you'll see immediately above letters and immediately below are diacritical marks that let you tell one consonant from another. Like, for instance, the letter B, T, the letter for TH, the letter for N, and the letter for Y are all the same basic consonantal stem, but with the dots in a different place, or two or three dots. So if you have a script that has very few of these marks, it introduces a lot of uncertainty as to what the text actually says. And that's what these earliest texts are like. The oldest Qurans have either no diacritics or some. And the ones that have some, there's not a consistent pattern in how they're used from manuscript to manuscript. Basic words can be pointed with great variety. I found in this manuscript, this word right here can be pointed 50 different ways. Just the consonants. Now, Muslims, when you bring this up, they'll say, oh, well, Arabic newspapers are a lot like this today. Well, they don't have the diacritical mark problem, but there is some truth in that. And they'll say, you can tell what it is from the context. And I tested this particular word, and I found that of those 50 ways, 42 were possible word forms, noun, verb, participle. 20 were actual Arabic word forms that you could find in a lexicon. But only one made sense in the context. And so they were right for that particular word. But scholars have found other places where it isn't so tidy. This Günter Luling that Jay mentioned is one of them. There are other variants. There's the long A and the Y are used in various ways, sometimes interchanged, sometimes missing. Hamza is a consonant in the Arabic text now, but it was not made a consonant in manuscripts until the 800s. So the earliest manuscripts don't have it. Sometimes it's represented by a vowel, but a lot of the time it's just missing completely. There are also other consonantal variants, and these appear to be copyist mistakes. I'll just run through those quickly. So anyway, with Quran variants, and these are ones in actual manuscripts, you'll find that the consonantal ones seem to be either copyist errors or they show a very flexible orthography before the script was phonetically standardized. It took Muslims 3 centuries to make Arabic script a complete phonetic system. Greek was already a complete phonetic system when the New Testament was being written. The effects of diacritical mark variants are lessened by the context, but they still cause problems. And you'll find that the commentaries on the Quran are full of debates about what is this word. And they center around these alternative ways of pointing them. Also, this third thing is very significant. In the actual manuscripts, there is no evidence of omitted or inserted words or phrases. Now, the Quran Jay mentioned as having the skip from 19 to 22 is very significant because here you have 2 entire chapters missing. No other manuscripts have that kind of phenomena. So what does that mean? Well, it shows that the consonantal text has gone through, has a high degree of standardization, and that even by the time that of our earliest manuscripts, there'd already been a concerted editing process. Also, there's evidence of the efficiency of Islam's historical assertion of suppression, this Uthman burning all these variant texts. Well, this is actually evidence that something that major did happen. Rather than evidence of a normal textual transmission. You know, Muslims make the assertion time and time again that the Bible's been changed, it's been corrupted. Our manuscript tradition shows it has not happened. No group had the power or the authority at one time to conform the manuscript tradition of the New Testament. Muslims did, and they used that power. In fact, from this early period, the first 300 years of Islam is a story of repeated, as the script got more precise, they had to suppress manuscripts that weren't as precise and that didn't conform to the new standard. So for that first three centuries of Islam, you actually have a huge process of editorial activity and also suppression. And Islamic tradition recognizes that. Now, the New Testament variants, they show a more normal variety of variants of an unsuppressed or standardized text, the same kind of thing you'd see in other Greek or Latin literature. You have the full range of variants that does not materially affect the meaning or the message of the text. This is a basic chart of the traditional view of the Islamic process of how the Quran came to be what it is today. First of all, Muhammad's preaching was memorized and also written down. It was committed to paper, parchment, papyrus, pottery, bones. By, like these seven different lines, you could extend it to over 20, his immediate circle of companions, his disciples, they made their own collections. These companions and his memorizers had these collections, and at about 650, 20 years after Muhammad's death, Uthman found it necessary to maintain unity among Muslims to destroy all the variant copies and just say one is going to be the standard. And that was done. Something that big was done. And then, between 615 and 900, any that escaped that process and any that arose in the in-between time were also conformed very precisely. And the manuscript tradition backs this up, that what we see in the manuscripts supports this. Now, this is the New Testament, just a general picture of the New Testament transmission. And you can see a huge disruption. You can see a huge disruption here with the Diocletian persecutions. Was it 306 AD? The edict went out, destroy Christian books. And a lot were destroyed. But that didn't happen throughout the whole empire. And there were areas outside the empire where Greek and other translation scriptures were available that were not destroyed. And after the persecutions were over, the New Testament textual transmission was reestablished. So it was never suppressed the way the Quran was. So what's a true comparison? I think we find that both Christian and Islamic traditions recognize the same kinds of textual variants. They both recognize variants that involve words, variants that involve sentences, phrases, even portions, large portions. And you could even say, for the Quran as well as the Bible, it doesn't materially alter what the basic text teaches. But the New Testament manuscripts still contain these, whereas the Quran ones do not. They've been purged.
asserting, Muslims asserting that the Quran's text has not been changed is very false and misleading. And Muslims asserting that the Bible's text has been corrupted is false and misleading. Both of these claims that Muslims make very vocally are straw man arguments. The original Quran text cannot be discovered from existing Quran manuscripts. And Muslims have no plan to do this. They don't want to do it. They don't like to do it. Because the whole story of the Quran text has been conforming an actual text to a dogma that this book is perfectly preserved on a tablet in heaven, and so our book has to match it. And that in their the history of the Quran has been trying to make the book actually match the dogma. What we actually have in our hands is a Quran of faith rather than a Quran of history, and it has a very questionable history. Whereas the original New Testament text can be discovered from existing New Testament manuscripts. We do have the New Testament of history, and it establishes our faith. So, double standards, just some quotes. Jay had a debate with a man named Shabir Ali. He's debated Shabir a number of times. But a few years ago, in one particular one, Bruce Metzger watched a video of it. And in a phone conversation with a friend of ours, he was asked, "What did you think of Shabir and how he handled the Bible?" And as part of that was textual variance and textual development in the New Testament. And his comment was just very simple. He makes much of little things. And this is a very typical Muslim polemic strategy. Stephen Massoud, who became a Christian out of Islam, and his little book, The Bible and the Quran, is probably the best single book out right now on the topic. He said this, "Documentary evidence shows that whereas the message has indeed been preserved, both books have suffered from editing errors and some variants in the text. Christians are very open about this matter. Information of variations in the biblical text can be found reproduced in most of the modern translations available to us. In contrast, we find that the present translations and commentaries of the Quran are silent about its variants and omissions. One has to go to the classical writings of Muslim scholars to obtain such information." Michael Nasr Ali, he's currently Bishop of Rochester in England, he said this, "The attitude of Christian scholars toward the variety of manuscripts available is in striking contrast to the Muslim position that there should be only one recension of the Quran available. As is well known, only the recension of the Quran made under the Caliph Uthman has survived. Therefore, when a modern edition or translation of the Quran is prepared, only one line of manuscript evidence is available. When a critical edition or translation of the New Testament is being prepared, scores of more or less variant manuscripts in many different ancient languages are available, and the critical text is established by sustained comparative work on these manuscripts. The survival of variant manuscripts is regarded as a strength by Christian scholars in establishing a critical text of the New Testament. The variations do not appear to compromise either the historical integrity of the New Testament or its reliability as a canon of Christian doctrine in any substantive way. The existence of a large number of manuscripts in different ancient languages, with their origins in widely separated churches, yet in substantial agreement with each other, is an argument in favor of the integrity of the scriptures." Stephen Massoud again said, "Whether Muslim or Christian, no one likes having their holy books criticized. However, if a book is held up as perfect, as having fully preserved the message of God, then its perfection should be demonstrable against all criticism and tests of its contents. The standards and measures chosen should be equally applicable to any book which calls itself inspired." So, taking the issues to them, Jay's done most of this for us. But you've seen right now a lot on textual problems.
First of all, the Quran's problem is, considering it as scripture, it does not live up to the claims being made for it, that it has been preserved perfectly. Even if one holds it has been preserved reliably, this is not good enough to make the claim that it has been preserved from eternity on a guarded tablet, which is Orthodox Muslim belief. Second, literary problems. Jay went through this. In numerous ways, it doesn't live up to the claim of being an inimitable book. Its errors are numerous, and just to repeat Noldecki's conclusion, it really is this: chaotic confusion, prosaic, stiffened style, tedious sermonizing, rhetorical, never metrical, the rhyme of the whole a burdensome yoke, superfluous verbiage. So that dogma turns a defective literary production into an unrivaled masterpiece in the eyes of the believers. That really is the case with the Quran. Other problems, the Quran has historical inaccuracies and scientific errors. Jay mentioned these. There are a lot of good books and websites that carry this kind of material. We're going to have those as links on the website that we put up. And just to think for a moment on the Bible's credentials as scripture. To demonstrate the Bible's credentials, there's a wealth of information on the internet and in print. We all know the different lines of evidence for showing the authenticity and integrity of the Bible. But permit me to end with a quote concerning New Testament textual criticism's contribution to supporting the Bible's credential. This is a personal testimony from Bruce Metzger, who's one of the greatest New Testament scholars that there's been. And this is in the book The Case for Christ by Lee Strobel, which is on sale upstairs. It's a great quote to have. All these decades of scholarship, Dr. Metzger was asked, of study, of writing textbooks, of delving into the minutiae of the New Testament text, what has all this done to your personal faith? I asked. Oh, he said, sounding happy to discuss the topic. It's increased the basis of my personal faith to see the firmness with which these materials have come down to us, with a multiplicity of copies, some of which are very, very ancient. So, I started to say, scholarship has not diluted your faith. He jumped in before I could finish my sentence. On the contrary, he stressed, it has built it. I've asked questions all my life. I've dug into the text. I've studied this thoroughly. And today I know with confidence that my trust in Jesus has been well placed. He paused while his eyes surveyed my face, and then he added, for emphasis, very well placed. And I'll end there. What time have we got? Would you like questions? We can go. Can we go till 5:30 if people want? No, there's not one yet. That's something I hope to get to personally in my research, but it'll be a while. The problem is so little has been done on the Quran text from this point of view. Muslims don't help us, and although there is a lot that can be done, and there are some incredible gifts from the Lord for this just recently. One's a photo archive that was thought to have been destroyed in World War II of some ancient Qurans that turns out it wasn't destroyed, and it's coming available for use. These Sana manuscripts that were found, some of those are available for study. Another Quran was recently found in Uzbekistan that's available for study. And as scholars from the West push on this issue, Muslims will need to respond, and more materials may come available.
Let me just say, there's another side of it, and that is the problem with security. Dr. Garrett Twin, when I asked him about those manuscript variants that he was showing me there, he told me that verbally. He has yet to publish that. Now, why has Dr. Quinn not published that? Well, the reason's very simple. He knows he's going to be debated on it. He knows he'll probably get a death threat. And I think that's been a real problem. It's an area of research where what you find may kill you. How many researchers are going to put their lives on the line? When I was first learning this material in 1994 at School of Oriental and African Studies, I started taking it down to Speaker's Corner and getting up on the ladder. And before I got up on the ladder, I just started doing some criticism from the base ladder, and I got knocked unconscious. And Dr. Hotting, who is my professor at that time, he stopped me in the hallway, and he asked me not to do this. He said, this is much too dangerous. And it is dangerous. Now, he knew that I was quoting his material, and he knew that his name would be put associated with what I was doing publicly. And the difficulty is that you will find scholars who are researching this in the West, not Muslim scholars. You won't find Muslim scholars doing this to the same degree. But even Western scholars who should know more and should certainly be at the forefront of this debate, not doing so, refusing to do so because of the death threats. Dr. Wandsboro and, but primarily the death threats. Dr. Patricia Kroner and Dr. Wandsboro from SOAS both had death threats put on them when they wrote, in his case, chronic studies in sectarian milieu in 77 and 78. Dr. Patricia Kroner, when she wrote Hagerism in 1975, she had a death threat put on her. She had to leave Oxford because of the difficulty she was finding there, went to Cambridge University. She is now at Princeton. And when I went to interview her, when I went to talk to her back in 1995, which is before I did my debate using her material, she was all excited that we were going to do this, but she would never do it. She says, I would dare not do this in public. It's much too dangerous. Surah 434 was one of them. The question is, what are you going to do with our text that also has similar verses or similar references, especially in the Old Testament, with the Quranic text? There's a number of ways we do that. If we're going to do women's issues, or let's just use violence, since the violence is the one they usually use it on, the violence of what happens with Joshua going into Jericho and killing all men, women, and children, and even donkeys. How can we say that our God is a God of peace? What I do, and I will take that on board, and I'll say, yes, of course we do, and we have to look at what was happening in 1400 B.C. when that was revealed. But also we need to ask, who is it and what is it that we follow? Do we follow the Mosaic model? Do we follow that model today as Christians? And the answer is no, we don't. We follow the model of Jesus Christ in the New Testament, where in Matthew 26:52, to Peter, he said, put away your sword, for he who lives by the sword dies by the sword. A completely different paradigm. And so for a Muslim, I'll ask him, if that is the paradigm that we're given in the New Testament in the first century, why would God then give us another model in the seventh century, which says, slay the unbeliever wherever ye find them, besiege them, lay in wait for them with every kind of ambush in Surah 9, Ayah 5. And there is 149 verses that refer to violence in the Medinan surahs. Certainly, you need to ask which is the revelation that is applicable today and which is the one we must follow. And I will do that, and I will stand categorically behind the gospel of Jesus Christ. But certainly, there are problem verses in the Old Testament. And there are problem verses in women's issues in the Old Testament. And that's why I always look to, and I always make sure that I follow the New Testament model and the person of Jesus Christ. Women's issues, on any issue, I will do that.
But there is not a Bible verse, Old Testament or New Testament, authorizing violence against your wife, like Surah 434. And just go for that. And just say, there's not one. women-friendly verses? About the most friendly is it says that men come from women, and they will use that.
And that's about it.
Yeah. 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 The comment was made. Yeah. That's right. Yes.
Muslims are trying to do that. I did a debate in Cambridge with Dr. Winter and Dr. Tamimi over that very issue, and I went to Surah 9-5, and I had Dr. Tamimi, who is a new convert to Islam. He's head of department at Cambridge University in theology, and Dr. Tamimi next to him, who is head of the MAB, who claimed to be a moderate Muslim. And when Dr. Winters looked at Surah 9-5, he said, we need to keep it in the 7th century. That's for the 7th century. It's dealing with certainly, it's not dealing with Jews. It's not dealing with Christians. It says, mushrikun, you're not a mushrik, Mr. Smith. This has nothing to do with you. And Dr. Tamimi jumped into that, says, yes, Mr. Smith, this has nothing to do with you. I said, well, then define who are the mushriks. And he says, well, the mushriks are the idolaters. I said, well, like Hindus? It just so happened most of the audience was made up of Hindus. And when he said yes, immediately there was a gasp in the audience. So the scripture condemned him. It did not condemn Winters. Winters doesn't have a problem with it because he contextualizes it for the 7th century. Now, immediately Tamimi and Winters start discussing amongst themselves as to what is applicable for today. And you can do that with Muslims who do take two different lines on that. Have them discuss it in front of you. It's a tactic we use all the time at Speaker's Corner. I'll get one Muslim who will take one position, another, and I'll just let them argue it out, and I'll let the crowd listen. And I'll say, can you see, this is an internal debate that's going on right now. It's a very important debate. For the first time, they're having to debate the violence in the Quran. They're having to debate the women's issues in the Quran. They're having to debate these, which would never have happened had we not had 9-1-1. Fortunately or unfortunately, in some ways it's made our job a lot easier because we've already gone through this debate with our scriptures. There's the beauty of it. We're way ahead of them on that. And engender it and let them have that and let them continue it.
Let me also just mention one thing that we are very burdened about is that our apologetics and our polemics are not insulting, are not now, Muslims do take offense. They take offense very easily. And they will often use taking offense as a weapon to try and quiet you down. But if you persist in not getting angry and in using a fair standard, you win the crowd. And there are Muslims listening. There are Muslims really paying attention to these issues and asking the hard questions. And they know they can't ask their fellow Muslims on these things. Otherwise, they'll get shut down. Yeah.
What is sort of regarded as inspired? Would the vowel pointing on the text actually be regarded as coming from the
right.
Catholics in heaven, or is it sort of like the Hebrew text the Masoretes added?
That's right. What's actually regarded as inspired of the Quran's text? Just the consonants or also the vowel pointing? You will find in the early Muslim Quran scholars, you'll find disagreement on this as the dogmas developed. And you'll find flexibility in the first 300 years, and the consensus view would be that the Uthmanic consonantal text, without diacritical marks, would be what's on the tablet in heaven. Now, that's not taking into consideration consonantal variants that were in the Companions' collections and in some other readings of the Quran, or like the three, I've looked at three old Quran texts so far, and I found some consonantal differences. Now, Muslims today, though, in their polemics, and the Muslims you will meet, and also things you will read, they will also include the vowels, and there are Muslim scholars who did include the vowels. So it's a lively question. It's one you could bring out, ask a group of Muslims, and you could start a bit of a discussion among them and help them realize how complicated this situation is. So, yeah. Go ahead.
Sure. Comment here.
Should make it into the. They want this on tape.
Okay. Right. I'm a country pastor in a rural area where there are no Muslims, but I'm very interested in it. And I feel in my own life a tension between two things, a tension between wanting to win Muslims for Christ, if perhaps I go to a city church in the future, and on the other hand, wanting, I hope, to defend what is left of Western Christendom against what I consider, and I'm sure we all do, as a jihad against that West. And I just wonder if you are aware of any similar tensions, you know, wanting to get the truth about the jihad against the West into the public arena, but that in itself might not be helpful in winning Muslim neighbours for Christ. That's the tension that I perceive, and I wonder if you would like to comment.
I'll make a quick comment, then, Jay, if you want to. I
feel that tension myself. And I think there is a role, I think in evangelism, you're right. Use issues like jihad guardedly, but you can use them. There are a lot of Muslims asking questions if they really want to follow a religion that authorizes jihad. And so it is a live issue, and it's not necessarily an issue that will get them angry. But also, I personally see there being a huge area for Christians in society, in culture, in politics, who have a very wise and open view and will openly resist Islamic attempts at jihad. Because it's not just military jihad. Islamic missionary activity is considered part of jihad. All the activity to get Islam taught in public schools is part of jihad in a Muslim mindset. And those things need to be resisted, and they need to be exposed. My son was just taught here in the last few weeks as part of his religious education about Islam, scientific proofs for the Quran. You know, that's not right. So we need Christians in places in society that can do this. And it's mentioned in your notebooks. There are people funding scholarships for Christians to be able to do studies to get them into these places. So if you know Christians who have a burden for this, let us know.
We get that almost every week, and the question is, what are we going to do with the Jews who lump us in the same boat with the Holocaust, and the Muslims who lump us with the Crusades? And it's a legitimate question, or the Inquisition in Spain, or even colonialism in the West. All of these are normal events. What I do with that, I usually, if a Muslim comes with me and asks that question, I ask them, first of all, do you not like the Crusades? Is there something about the Crusades you don't like? And they said, well, yes. And I said, well, then you tell us, what is it about the Crusades that bothers you? And I said, well, when you have one people forcing themselves on another people and eradicating their culture, we don't like that. Okay, well, I agree with you. We have something that we in common. I make sure the whole crowd hears it. So at least the Jew and the Christian are agreeing on that one point. I said, so we both start from the same premise that one group should not, certainly, or a follower or a leader of one group should not eradicate the beliefs and impose their own beliefs on another group. I said, if you hold that to be true, can you tell me what the Prophet did in the 7th century between 624 and 627? Well, actually, 622 and 627, when the three Jewish tribes living under his jurisdiction, under his dominion, the Banu Qaynuqa and the Banu Nadir and the Banu Qurayza family, all three of these Jewish families who controlled the commerce at that time, who he tried to ally first for the first 2 years, but then when they refused to accept him as a prophet, he then eradicated, threw them out. And by 627, the last remaining Jewish tribe, the Banu Qurayza, 800 of their men had their throats slit in one afternoon. The women were taken as concubines, the children as slaves. I said, we would have a name for that, and I would say that I find that abhorrent. Would you, as a Muslim who have just now defined what the Crusades say, would you be willing to criticize that? And are you willing, in the same token, because you're criticizing the Crusades, are you willing to do that? I've never had a Muslim yet who will be willing to do that. I said, well, then you're basically, you have a double standard here. But see, as a Christian, I find both examples apparent. I do not, and I will condemn the Crusades for one very good reason. I always want to know what Jesus Christ would have done. If I wear that bracelet, WWJD, what would Jesus do? And I would ask, what would Jesus say about the Crusades? What would Jesus say about the Inquisition? I know his answer, because he's already said that. He's already shown that in the Gospels. So therefore, I as a Christian have all the right in the world to go back and condemn whenever the church gets it wrong, because I will use Jesus as my standard. But you as a Muslim who've already defined that you don't like what happened in the Crusades are not willing to use that same standard. You cannot use that same standard, because your standard has to go back to Muhammad. Can you see there's a double standard here? And then I go to the crowd and I say, now you've got to make a choice. Are you going to go for the standard that we see in Jesus Christ, or are you going to go for the standard that we see in the 7th century example of Muhammad as a prophet? For a Muslim, we hang them every time on that. I think we need to start doing that. I think it's important that we do start showing that Muhammad is just not relevant for today. I don't want to use the example of the church, because the church gets it wrong. And Muslims don't want to use the example of Islam, because they get it wrong. We've got to go back to our authority. We've got to go back to our paradigm. And for the Muslim, they have to go back to Muhammad. For me, I have to go back to Jesus Christ. But what a comparative. What an apologetic. And what a time. It's so timely for today.
No one will ever fight the sword of Jesus.
Say again?
No one will ever fight the sword of Jesus.
No, you won't. Nor his followers. Or with Saul, who becomes Paul. What another beautiful example.
Let me make just a quick comment, too. Just a quick comment on this. Do you realize that the Crusades is the first time that violence was that a doctrinal justification for religion, for violence as an act of piety, was asserted in Christianity about 1,000 years after Jesus? It took that long for someone to get it wrong. With Islam, it's there from the outset. And that's something our own cultures don't, you know, aren't recognizing, even about the Crusades. So, yes.
Defensive jihad.
Or personal striving?
Yeah.
The question is, what is jihad? We're being told today that it's fighting against your personal sin rather than holy war. I dealt with that yesterday in the lectures yesterday, 2 days ago, in the pre-forum things, if you want a more lengthy treatment. But the short answer is that in Orthodox Islamic dogma, there are two jihads, the greater and the lesser. The greater is the striving against personal sin. And that's getting emphasized today a lot. It's actually an emphasis that was not there at the outset of Islam, and it took many centuries to develop, and it came from Sufi or mystical Islamic sources. There's a guy right now named David Cook who's just published a book on jihad, and he documents this
through the centuries.
There's then, in addition to the greater jihad, there's the lesser jihad, and this is the one Muslims are just being quiet about. They're omitting mention of this. And the lesser jihad includes, and still includes, military action to advance the rule, the domination of Islam, as well as missionary activity. Now, the situation is a little bit further complicated, too, in that since colonialism and the end of colonialism, the established Muslim governments in most of the countries have adopted a view that jihad is self-defense. They have been content with the borders as they stand. And so their jurists and the Islamic legal systems that are justifying their rule have developed a doctrine of jihad as self-defense. And so you'll also hear that.
Tomorrow we'll go into some of those verses and we'll exegete them for you and show you how moderates and radicals are taking the same verse and they're exegeting it two different ways. I'll show you how it's been done.